The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's savings specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Now, yesterday was the 92nd anniversary of the establishment of the Irish Free State, and we thought it was as good a thing as any opportunity as any to have a look at some aspect of life and government in Ireland since then. And you might be surprised to know, it sounds like such a long, long time ago, that we've only had 13 Taoiseach in that time. Now, we've been joined in studio by Ón Oireachtain, former government press secretary who worked with three different Taoiseach, by Michael Kennedy, historian at the Royal Irish Academy, and still with us in studio are Lindsay and Charlie Bird and John Downing. Now, John, you wrote a book about the present Taoiseach called The Accidental Taoiseach. What was it?
Was it the unlikely Taoiseach?
I also had a go at writing a smaller book about Bertie Ahern.
That was
way, way back. But I did.
Why do you say unlikely?
Because he was, for all of his life, he announced, he announced in February 2001 that he was challenging for the leadership of Fine Gael, to the astonishment of all his parliamentary colleagues. That was the time that Michael Noonan and Jim Mitchell pulled the rug from under John Bruton. Mm-hmm. So he was de facto saying he wanted to be Taoiseach in February 2001. He had been in the Dáil since November 1975.
Long
the
time.
Number yeah. of his colleagues who said, he was briefly a junior minister and briefly a member of a sort of junior second string member of cabinet, the number of colleagues who said, we love you, Enda, you're great fun, you're a great man at the Christmas party and all the rest of that, but we never knew you wanted to be Taoiseach. And so that was 2001. He lost that. It goes on even as late as June 2010. The people he had chosen as his key lieutenants wanted him out. They didn't believe he could get there. Even, and that was June 2010. By February 2011, he was Taoiseach. So he was forever the most unlikely person to be Taoiseach.
Right. You worked with him.
I did.
Yeah. What do you think are the qualities, first of all, that one might need in principle to be a Taoiseach, and secondly, the ones that he brought to bear on it?
Well, certainly the one that I think he brings to bear on immediately that is stamina and energy, and he has it in abundance, and you need it in abundance. I suppose the stamina to have been there for 36 years to start with,
yeah,
and the experience that you gain across that. But the energy, the levels of energy required of Taoiseach, particularly in the modern era now, in the way the media has gone, it's 24-hour cycle. It is not unusual for Taoiseach to be up before Morning Ireland and be still at it at 12 o'clock midnight, and having gone through a series of very, very important meetings where you have to stay on top of the game. So it's physical stamina and it's mental stamina is required. And it is one thing that Enda Kenny impresses me with no end about is his bundles of energy that he can apply to the job.
Now, I know that you've done work on other Taoiseach, Michael Kenny, but what about the vision thing?
I think you have to have that if you're Taoiseach or President of the Executive Council, as it was up to 1937. And you look at some Taoiseach that, or presidents who might not in the public opinion or public mind have got that. Somebody like W.T. Cosgrave, the first holder of the office, who did have that vision thing, even though we might not think of it, that he wanted to make sure that Ireland was seen internationally as a working state, that Ireland was open for business. I mean, think of what Owen was saying about stamina. Someone who takes over during a civil war and who has to keep the state, a new state.
Remind people when he took over and how he took over.
Well, he took over as chairman of the provisional government in August 1922, and that government was from Michael Collins after Collins was assassinated. And his function from December 1922 on, when the Free State comes into being, is to show that Ireland's open for business, because a new democracy, a new state formed after the First World War, still fighting a civil war, we have to show that we're not, in modern terms, a failed state. And that's the message of 1920s Ireland. We're open for business, we're a functioning democracy, we're a small, effective state,
yeah,
and we're not Britain, we're not part of Britain anymore. And Cosgrave, I think, succeeds in that. He has that vision.
Right.
But it's a vision that is very kind of down to earth, and perhaps it doesn't inspire the voters, and that's one of the reasons in 32
that is kind of mundane.
It's mundane,
yeah, yeah, but important, I suppose. If
huge
you take
thing, yeah,
because if you take, well, when I was in school doing history, there was a full stop, and there was no discussion beyond a certain point, because it was just all too difficult.
Yes.
And the memory of the Civil War, which to me was history, but to the people in office was still very, very, very sensitive and bitter and dreadful things
that
had been done.
That Cosgrave and his government had to take the executions during the Civil War, the 77 executions. And that is something that no leader really wants to have to do, to execute his former colleagues, his former political associates,
yeah,
and to keep the state functioning in a period where it is under threat from within, where there is a real possibility, although it's a short-lived, of the state going under and the British coming back and all the threats that are there from London. So Cosgrave really has a very tough job initially, but, and you think 40% of the state's budget goes on reconstruction after the Civil War. So he and his colleagues, and they're a very difficult bunch of colleagues that he has to manage. And I think that's something.
His colleagues?
Well, you think of people like Kevin O'Higgins, Dick Mulcahy, Desmond Fitzgerald, John Marks O'Sullivan, Paddy McGilligan. They're all personalities and strong personalities in their own right. And there's Cosgrave with his quiet resolve running the cabinet. And, you know, to use Brian Farrell's analogy of chairman or chief. But
yeah,
Cosgrave is the boss, and he's known as the boss, and I think that's where he's very, very effective in keeping the show on the road.
And also the smooth transition then to Dev,
given
again the history of the Civil War.
Yes, Cosgrave is a Democrat through and through, and that is what shows the effectiveness of the state. And Owen and I were talking earlier about decisions that Taoiseach have to take that may be ones that end their political careers, and this is perhaps something that Cosgrave undertakes, in terms of he knows that power has to be handed over. I don't think rumours of a coup are in any way very strong, but this sense of this is the democratic transition, this is what a state has to do, and this is the state we've built up functioning properly. Ireland is a functioning democracy now, and you think of how many of the states of Europe after 1919, the new states who ended up as dictatorships or where democracy didn't function by 1939. What Cosgrave and De Valera do, although on different sides of the Civil War, show that Ireland can function, and Ireland is a properly functioning democracy in 1939.
See you nodding at that, Lindsay.
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting, because I just give a plug to Michael Laffin's biography of Cosgrave, which has just come out actually at the Royal Irish Academy, and that's the point he makes, is the achievement. It was quiet and understated, but it was really revolutionary, that achievement, 10 years of stability. But also they faced huge social issues. You're talking about the 40% expenditure, huge issues of housing, poverty. They had to make very unpopular cuts on the pension.
Now
they paid themselves handsomely, however, I have to say.
Arnaud de Bly, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of the the social kind of legacy we have comes from there as well. Taoiseach were paid very handsomely compared to the average salary. I think Cosgrave was £1,500, whereas you're talking about a labourer earning 15 shillings a week. So, you know, it wasn't progressive in a social sense at all. And it gives us an indication that we had possibly a revolution in terms of a handover of power, but not a cultural, not a social revolution at all. Nonetheless, the achievement politically was massive. There's no doubt about that.
We move along then to Eamon Dev. Now, he was in and out. Tell us about him. Because we all remember him, I think, as president, but not really as Taoiseach.
The one point I want to make, I suppose, about De Valera is we have to remember he was a young man once. And there's a letter he sends when he's in New York as president of Doyle Aarons in 2021. And he talks about an Irish-American politician coming into the Waldorf Astoria Hotel where he was staying. He said, "I didn't like that guy. I was going to chuck him through the window of the hotel." Now, that's not the De Valera that we think of.
Absolutely,
you know, in the black cape and the wide black hat, talking to priests and nuns, and he is very—he has the vision thing as well. I mean, he sees Ireland on the world stage, and he embodies Ireland. And I think where I like to see him is more from the international point of view. That he was seen as an important statesman in the 1930s. John Gunther, who was a writer in the 30s, produced books on sort of prominent Europeans, and De Valera is always in there. His stance at the League of Nations, his role every year at Geneva, and he embodies Ireland in that. I mean, he knows he embodies Ireland. He is seen
well,
as
he
Ireland.
Claims that he embodies Ireland, but if you take the labourer earning what?
15 shillings a week. Yeah, yeah. But it's true. What Michael's saying is interesting, though, because De Valera is the one that gets that period called after him. You know, De Valera's Ireland. Now, recent historiography have put the S on it, De Valera's Ireland's, because obviously there was those people on 15 shillings. But yeah. It is, I think what he was able to do was infuse Ireland at that time with a sense of itself.
Yes, he has an aura that appeals to the
particularly Irish.
Labour.
Yeah. And he was able to cross that, even though he was talking to very different social sectors, culturally he was able to, and politically he seemed to be able to represent really very diverse.
But he seemed,
but
he seemed to be Neanderthal in terms of what we call social policy or economic policy. I mean, things like the economic war, hello.
But that's all, that's politics. That's the politics of sovereignty. That's of the time, I think, that right protectionism was fashionable in Europe in the 1930s. But this is a way of making the economic question political. It's all about sovereignty and British-Irish relations and being independent from Britain. And as I think as Sean T.
The definition of Ireland, of Irish being not British.
Yeah, we've had a crack at John Bull. I think that's the way Sean T. O'Kelly put it. And that's what De Valera is trying to do to prove that it's all about sovereignty. And we are a sovereign, independent state and we'll make our way in the world in our own manner. Maybe he has to only look into his heart to see what that would be. And that's his vision. And it's, I think it's one that, as Lindsay was saying, it appeals to the wider audience because there's an aura there. It can mean whatever you want it to mean because you see him succeeding. Even in hard times, the economic war is perfect for that because it looks like we're having a go at Britain. But in fact, people are suffering during the economic war and farmers aren't able to export.
Dreadful.
Things aren't good, but it's wrapped up.
That said, Marion, their social policies were not bad on housing, things like that, compared to what had gone before them. So there was actually some quite imaginative stuff done during that period in the 30s and in terms of unemployment benefit and various extensions of what we would now call the welfare state.
Right.
So it was actually a better time for that labourer in some senses, not a great time for rural Ireland because of the economic war. But in some sense, they were more imaginative, in many, many ways than what had gone before them. So and that gets kind of airbrushed.
How were you taught De Valera?
Well, I think by the 70s, there was, for example, I remember the Leaving Cert history book, which was pretty scathing of De Valera. It was relatively new. I think we saw him as a very divisive figure in the early 20s and certainly didn't help the prospects for a civil war. Managed to be the hurler on the ditch, while a lot of young people died and so on in a very bitter war. Economically challenged, but socially very, I think, going with what Lindsay said.
Yeah.
And an argument that Fianna Fáil, the early Fianna Fáil, was in fact Ireland's Labour Party.
Right. Yes. Yeah, well, they often don't.
Certainly the Michael Collins film certainly portrayed De Valera in a very negative light. And I think that's how young people in Ireland will recognise De Valera.
I think that's very unfortunate.
Yeah, but I think it is. But I think that's the way it was presented in the film.
Right.
Yes. And I think that probably reflected what was coming through to those who directed presented that film, that's what they got in the history books as well, which I think is very unfair on De Valera.
It neglects the weight that's on his shoulders, perhaps say in the summer of 1940 when it looks as either Britain or Germany are going to invade, that here is the Taoiseach who is going to have to potentially bring Ireland into the Second World War. And there's a set of files in the National Archives that are the cabinet minutes or the cabinet meetings that never took place. They're the agendas for the meeting that would take place after the invasion. And they are spine-tingling when you read them. What De Valera will have to do to bring the army into the field, to make a message to the nations of the world that British troops or German troops have arrived on our soil. And that sense of responsibility, I think, is huge.
And I think that's the common denominator across all Taoiseach, regardless of parties, throughout the history. And at the end of the day, the book stops there. That you can have all these, you can, like, a lot of people refer to him as the kind of chairperson type of Taoiseach.
Yeah.
And all that. At the end of the day, he has to take the tough decisions, I think. You know, some of them are, you know, maybe political type decisions, like removing a cabinet minister, getting rid of one of his, Frank Flannery, getting one of his trusted advisors for years and all that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, politics kind of carries through at the end, and he had to be the leader at that time, no longer the chairperson.
Right.
De Valera had the same issue, maybe in a different, probably more catastrophic kind of decisions to be made.
Yeah.
But I saw Brian Cowan making those exact same decisions that he knew, because he was a long time in politics. He knew that the decisions that he had to take were, I suppose, they were detrimental. They were career-ending decisions for him. Yet he took those decisions because that's what is expected of a leader.
I find it fascinating, the discussion, because it brings you back to the fact that the political system in this country was born out of a very bloody civil war, and lots of awful things happened.
Yes.
And the political parties end up, you know, particularly Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in opposition. And now you have Sinn Féin, who have come from a violent past as well, now in the mix and in the milieu. And as I said earlier in the previous discussion, you may find, I think it's going to be inevitable, whatever about Sinn Féin being in government, but I believe that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, what might have been unthinkable, that the people who run these parties now know that we are in a period of coalitions, and there were independents and there were coalitions, Clan na Talu and Clan na Public in the past, that politics evolves. And we were joking about early on, are we a banana republic? We're not, in that sense, that when people go to the ballot box, people are elected.
Right.
And that's what happens.
OK, so we had W.T. Cosgrove, Eamon de Valera. Then we had John A. Costello, Eamon de Valera, John A. Costello, Eamon de Valera, before we got Lamass. John A. Costello.
Costello, it would be easy to be cruel about him and say, well, he didn't have the vision. He was the accidental Taoiseach, or a reluctant Taoiseach, I think is the David McCullough's biography of him. But he had to do a very different job to his predecessors. He had to keep a very difficult group of parties together in our first coalition government. And when you're dealing with somebody like Sean McBride as the head of Clan na Public, who's forever sniping at him, William Norton, Labour Party, and the Farmers Party, and the independents that support that government.
How many were in that government?
Oh, Lord, are there six parties in it? Just off the top of my head, I can't remember. Five or six.
History repeating itself.
Yeah. Yeah. He has to be very well. Yeah. But I would also make the point that Costello didn't have the experience all other Taoiseach had, you know, like in the Kenny now, 36 years kind of learning the craft. I think Bertie was, 20 years before he came to Taoiseach. Brian Cowan, 23, 24. Similarly, John Bruton. You know, like it's not a job you can learn on the job. You know, there's no honeymoon period,
right,
even though they talk about it. You're in. That's it.
The only person I think did that is not one of our own was Tony Blair. He had no experience when he went in. I often thought about that, that he had to kind of make it up.
But American presidents have no experience when they're put in there normally, in the sense that they're not...
Anyway, come back to our own. Tell me more about Costello.
He's a lawyer, but he has no national record. If you like, he wasn't out in 1916. He was studying at the bar. And that's what makes him perfect for Taoiseach, that he's... He doesn't have... Dick Mulcahy, the Fine Gael leader, who probably should have been Taoiseach, he's tainted by the executions during the Civil War. McBride won't have him as Taoiseach, so a compromise emerges, and that's John A. Costello. And so Costello has to look inwards rather than look outwards to the country. He has to be that safe pair of hands to allow the coalition parties to keep to keep them together, to function. Yeah, but he has problems in that he doesn't have the experience that we were talking about, that McBride begins to run rings around him, cabinet government begins to collapse. McBride has the cabinet secretary Maurice Moynihan removed because he doesn't trust him. He says he's too pro Fianna Fáil, too pro De Valera, and so the whole business of government begins to collapse during the inter-party government. Now, Costello does keep them together from 1948 to 51. It's quite an achievement.
Yeah.
But all the time, the rigour of government is under strain because of the coalition. You'd have, for example, McBride bringing cabinet memoranda that should go through the Department of the Taoiseach, through structures in there. He brings them to the cabinet meeting in his own briefcase and says, here, lads, have a look at these. And by the way, he's Minister for External Affairs, but he would submit a memorandum on any aspect of policy. And that, of course, doesn't go down well in the other departments when you think of ministers being chief executives of their own department. Mm. So a very, very difficult job for Costello to do.
And testament to that, I think, is the mother and child controversy. It's the first time where you really get... splashed out on the media and the newspapers in the way we're used to every Sunday, the inner workings of how government is lobbied by the church, by the medical profession. And I think part of the reason that spills out onto the media, obviously Noel Brown plays a key role, who is the Minister for Health, young again, somebody who wasn't going to follow procedure. But it's partially because it's the first coalition and because there's a lot of inexperience and because protocol isn't always followed, then the drama gets played publicly for one of the first times. And it's the beginning of the end too, in many senses, of that concordat between church and state.
Yes.
From then on, you don't ever see the same sort of church state. And actually, that's really interesting about the
Would
coalition.
Would you say that was the beginning of the end?
I think so, yeah. And I'll tell you what, John Charles McQuaid agrees with me. He wrote his note to the Pope Nuncio in 1956 and said, we are now officially in an anti-ecclesiastical state. And he blamed De Valera for that, actually, which is really interesting, because De Valera's handling of the church is so nuanced, very interesting. It's not at all what you would think from the outside when you get into the archives. He negotiates so well. At the end of the day, he writes the constitution, he takes advice, but he writes the constitution he wants to write. It's the same thing with the mother and child, because it's him who negotiates it through before the coalition party, and it's him who comes in and mops up the mess afterwards in 851, 52, 53. And it's so interesting to see that.
No truck with the church. His personal faith is one thing, but someone who's been excommunicated during the Civil War.
He can take it. And that's where he's, as a politician, just in terms of the way he uses the role of politics, that is where he's really second to none. It's why he lasts 16 years.
Right, we come on to Sean Lemass. Sean Lemass always gets a good press.
He does, and maybe he shouldn't. He's a gambler, he's a bluffer, and in terms of luck, which I think is a very important factor as well, the rising tide raises all boats, and he's in the right place at the right time. And he's able to portray that image of being the Europeanist, the moderniser. He achieves a great deal, but Ireland is on the way up, and the first programme for economic development, the Whitaker Plan, has been introduced by the previous coalition government. So he is in the right place at the right time. But he gives confidence
to... Is that luck?
I think
does
it is.
Luck matter in these things?
Oh, I think so.
It's huge.
So.
Yeah.
Timing.
But Lemass is able to inspire a country that's on his knees, and I think that's something that's really important.
It?
Yeah, to give a sense of leadership and vision into Europe, and to get Ireland back on the world stage again, and to make Ireland a prosperous economy and a thriving economy.
And
he's able to do that.
To re-articulate what Ireland comes to mean, in the sense that he's the one who attempts to broker a new vision. So the previous vision had been offering your life up for Ireland, that kind of patriotism. And then that rebrokering he brings to it is this idea that it's the economy for Ireland. That you work for Ireland, that you spend for Ireland, which is something we're now, we don't even think about. But that was quite a new idea, that economics is patriotism.
Right. He was also very lucky in his first secretary. What were they called at the time? They weren't called first secretary. Ken Whitaker.
Oh, and the head of the Department of Finance. Yes, he was very lucky. There was a very powerful group of very able civil servants there in the Committee of Secretaries who were implementing government policy. So it was a very lucky time from that point.
But Lemass, by contrast, I felt that, thinking about this and what Taoiseach need and the kind of supports that they need, and you see the support that the current Taoiseach gets from his wife, and you can go to John Bruton and Gareth Fitzgerald and all that. But I read about Lemass once that his wife, when he was resigning, he told her that morning, I'm going to work, by the way, I'm resigning today. There was none of this kind of, this confidential discussion that you would imagine would happen in most Taoiseach's household before they would.
Really?
Of course, that's the other unspoken, Marion. The obvious thing you need to be a Taoiseach is, I won't say what genitalia part, but you need to be male to date.
To date.
I have to say, if you're going to bring wives into the equation.
Right. Okay, listen, I'm going to have to take another break. We've a fair few to get through. So we've Jack Lynch, Liam Cosgrave, Jack Lynch, Charles Haughey, Gareth Fitzgerald, and on up to today. Well, we've done a little bit on Endicott. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to the programme, and we are just going through the various Taoiseach we had since the beginning of the state. A couple of calls in on this. Interesting that stamina and energy come in before integrity and principles in terms of the attributes required of the leader.
That's the reality of it.
Thanks for identifying the 6th of December as the birthday of the state. I've always been surprised that our birthday went unnoticed. Another one says, 3 cheers for Bertie. And another one says, Dev was a disaster. How many Irish people had to go to John Bull to work? We'll come back, we'll skip around here because we don't have to go in any order. Bertie, he's in the papers again today. He's saying, why don't we use experienced people? He's clearly saying, like me, like himself, I mean, in the way Bill Clinton is used, in the way
Gordon Brown
saved the day. Yeah. Talking about
Taoiseach and, the three that I worked with in particular, that I think events, you mould to deal with events. And certainly, I think the big event at the time, okay, it was 11 years in office and obviously a lot of things happened. We had the Celtic Tiger and we have the row, was that kind of, was that built on a foundation of sand or whatever it was. But the one big thing that Bertie stepped up to in a realistic way and in a determined way was the peace process. And like, so, you know, he was the man for that particular moment. Likewise, I would say Brian Cowan, when I mentioned it earlier, when he had to step up to something. And then when Enda Kenny came in as Taoiseach, the big thing that was required by the incoming government was the plan was in place to continue on with the plan, the recovery plan, but to sell Ireland internationally. And I would defy anybody to find anyone as good as Enda Kenny doing that on the international stage.
Bertie was no slouch at that.
Oh, no, he wasn't. But I'm talking, at that particular moment, our reputation, you know, was tarnished at that. And he bought around so quickly. Now, I know the tide was rising and all that kind of stuff. But so I think the events mould the individual. The individual kind of looks at, you might have come in with a vision. And Enda Kenny, as we've often, and some people kind of cynically laugh and say, you know, great country to, you know, do business. What's the man to do business and to grow old? And we kind of laugh at that. That's his actual vision. And if you drill into that and say, what's he actually saying that? You know, that's about fixing all the health. That's, you know, getting all the jobs and everybody gets. If you achieve that, you have achieved a wonderful vision. What a wonderful place it would be. But the first thing he had to do when he came in was to get Ireland back on the international stage. And he did it in absolute spades. And he was wonderful on the international stage at that. So I do think that the events at the time that Taoiseach... I know you can point to other failings within all that, but you have to be able to decompartmentalise. You know, we're dealing with this. It's the chairman, that's minister is dealing with that. I'm kind of taking the kind of helicopter view of the whole thing to be able to go in and focus and deal with that. And that's what, and that's the three Taoiseach that I worked with. They were
you
able
sound
to
like
do
the government
that.
Press secretary.
I'm trying to be all fair to all three.
He didn't issue the same message at home and abroad. That was a crucial problem. When he was busy saying abroad we'd all spend too much and got crazy and telling us at home it wasn't our fault, there was a real problem with the fact the way the domestic and the foreign message was managed. It wasn't consistent, to say the least.
Marion, you know, there is another important thing. You know, the Taoiseach are lucky, but also the people that they have around them, the civil servants, the top people in the government departments play a huge role. And that's what I see it from outside.
So, yeah.
You know, Enda Kenny or whoever else can travel all over the world, but it's the ambassadors, the people that they have on the ground, that they really do. These are the people. It's like the president. It's like Michael D going to China today and he's been around doing things. I'm not taking away, by the way, from the effort of what Taoiseach do. But the quality of the civil servants, the top civil servants who are around the top politicians, that's what makes the connection in a way.
Yeah, and historically, that's a really important point.
I think,
to make.
You know, you can...
The 1930s, a man called Joseph Walsh was the head of the Department of External Affairs. He was the Secretary General. De Valera was Minister for External Affairs as well as Taoiseach. But most people, certainly in Britain, which is the key point of foreign policy, thought Joe Walsh was the Minister for External Affairs. And a lot of British politicians and diplomats did as well. Our ambassadors have done a huge job. Again, in London, John Delante, who was our High Commissioner at the time there. You think of somebody like Tommy Kiernan in the United States during the Kennedy presidency, who underscores getting organising JFK's visit. You think of the role of diplomats in the peace process in the 1980s, 90s. You know, it's hugely important. And because of the nature of our governmental system and our political system, our administrative system, they go basically unremembered. They're behind the scenes, and that's the way
there's the good side and the bad side of that.
Yes.
You know, yeah. I mean, in one sense, if you take what Brian Cowan was dealing with, the department came in for an awful lot of criticism, the Department of Finance, but it's the politician that takes the hit for it, as it were, reputationally.
Very true, yes.
Democracy.
Yeah. But he says Enda Kenny has great enthusiasm. I mean, Bertie Ahern, I mean, he had a brush. He was never stopped, you know, he was up earlier than anybody else in this country, you know. I mean, and that's a great quality, but it's not the only thing that being a Taoiseach is about. It's to deliver things for people in the end. And, you know, is it true that all politics ends in failure? Probably it is. And that, you know, Enda Kenny must be looking at himself today and saying, listen, what's going to happen in 18 months' time? And we're talking about the Civil War. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in government. He may be the person who has to really stand up, if you want to call it, to the plate and say, I'm prepared to do it for
well,
the sake of the country.
Well, it might be no bad thing to end the blooming civil
war. It probably wouldn't.
You know, I
mean, it comes back to John's analogy earlier on. What is it, 79 plus? That's what the game is.
Mm, right. Now, we go back. So, Jack Lynch, you were making the point. He was the only
the
one.
The first Taoiseach born in the 20th century. Yeah, which is kind of interesting. So the first one to be, and actually not born, though, prior to the setting up of the state. So we reckon it was, well, we could be correct on this, either 1916, 1917, we're not sure.
Mm-hmm, 1916.
But certainly before the foundation of the state still, but within the 20th century, which is quite interesting. So
right.
It took you know, and that's, there is a generational shift there, too, because even though Lamass is associated with being modern, and so he's very much of the old guard, actually. And so the
he was associated with 1916.
Yes,
absolutely, and very much associated with that. And I think so. Jack Lynch is sort of the first that isn't. Not that that does him much good in the end.
Well, he's a
compromise. Yeah.
He's a stopgap. In his first couple of years, he's seen as a stopgap between Charlie Haughey and George Colley. And it's really only the arms crisis that, one, it shows how he has, if we use the sporting metaphor, let the ball drop in the outbreak of the Troubles, and that he really doesn't see it coming. But then by the arms crisis, I think he's made. But he is an unlucky Taoiseach to an extent for domestic affairs, international affairs, the world economy, the way after the 77
but he was
election.
Also, I mean, the promises that he made
landed
us long term in difficulties
indeed.
That we're still coping with today, you know.
Yeah.
By eliminating, making promises that were off the Richter scale. Mm. But anyway, do you think events made him then?
I think he was greatly toughened up by the arms crisis, that he is somewhat lackluster. He's a bit limp before that. And, you know, the sporting hero.
He was more popular than God, virtually.
Hugely popular. But I feel he's the first Taoiseach who's kind of brought along by his media handlers, by his civil servants. He's very much managed between 1966 and 69, 70. And if you look at the cabinet minutes for say, August 69, the outbreak of the Troubles, the shop is falling apart, that the business of government is collapsing again, and there's he's not able to control the elements within his cabinet, the Haughey Blaney factions, and question of whether he really does know what's happening vis-a-vis Northern policy. Does he know that arms are being imported by members of the cabinet to send to the North?
Do you believe he did?
I would imagine he did, but I've no absolute evidence.
The fool or knave theory.
Yeah, exactly.
If he didn't, he should have.
He should have. But the way he structures the cabinet committees dealing with Northern Ireland is certainly a very peculiar way, unless he wanted to be able to stand back and say when the thing was caught by, to say, well, I knew nothing about it, whether it was kind of sense of expendability of certain members of the cabinet, that he's cleverer than he lets himself on to be, but I really don't know from the evidence I've seen archivally.
In a sense, too, I think Jack Lynch as well, it's the second generation in sense of politics since the foundation stage, and you do see that type of politics really lasting right through to Bertie Ahern.
Yeah, and Lamass is responsible for that, for bringing that generation, the men in the mohair suits. And I think to critique Lamass,
that
is something
he's
responsible for, and not setting up his succession, standing back and saying, I'm done, 1966, I'm resigning, I'm not doing it on health grounds, my time is to go. And I think he did have a feeling.
Yeah, not a lot of people do, though, do they? There's no great tradition of
that. That is a great sign of leadership, to recognise when the time
is.
It is. I suppose the most difficult, really.
Yeah.
And to be able to read the events and say the tide is turning or whatever.
Yeah.
And to go, and I think we have.
But
did
Taoiseach do that? And did Bertie Ahern do that on his own? Do they do it on their own, or do people go to them, or maybe their family say it to them?
I couldn't possibly comment.
You were in there.
Now you sound like a press secretary.
Again.
That's for sure. Okay, listen, I'm going to have to take another break. Back with you after this. Welcome back to the programme. Now, caller was on to say, did you know that Fianna Fáil is the longest serving democratically elected party in the world? Over 75 years serving in government. I think that's an interesting argument for the need for a rejuvenation of Irish politics. Another caller said he would have thought that Charlie was the best on the international stage. He had great confidence and never acted like we were a small country. Another one says Albert Reynolds did all the donkey work, re the North. And that's another true. One said Bertie was very different to Enda. You really felt he was across every department, and he had great emotional intelligence, great problem solver, also feel Charlie was in control. Let me go back now to Jacqueline. I just thought it was very funny you were saying in the commercial break, Jacqueline used to go home for his dinner every day to Rathgar. But so did Gareth.
I think so. It's a very different time of government.
Yeah.
A slower pace.
No
at
social
times.
Media.
No,
no one tweeting it. No.
And that your card room was much, much smaller. Was that right, John?
Absolutely.
The which was?
The Paul Carr's room was a lot smaller.
Or they didn't have a rebuttal unit. When was the rebuttal unit?
The pre-bottle unit.
What, the rebuttal, was it?
Pre-bottle.
Oh, pre-bottle and then the rebuttal.
Yet you do see some very early Taoiseach using media quite effectively. Yeah. That Cosgrave, in some of his talky broadcasts, as you could call them, are a very effective communication to certainly the American market. Dev does the same thing. He has
see the early posters and cartoons and stuff, the artwork of Fianna Fáil produced is absolutely amazing. Very, very cutting edge.
Now we move along to Liam Cosgrave. Were you in the reporting business by then?
No, not for Liam Cosgrave. I was.
He was 73 to 77.
Yeah, I was a researcher in RTE, I was.
I do remember the lampooning on television of that and
Frank
the Minister
Hall.
For Art.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which was very entertaining, it has to be said.
Yeah.
But I presume, is that very difficult on politicians when, if somebody gets it right,
when they get it right, I don't think politicians mind that much when they get it right, but when it becomes personalised, I think that's very hurtful both to the politicians and those around them. But if you hit the note right, I think most politicians, because they're in that, you know, they live in the public sphere, they have a good laugh at it. But it's when you cut it to the bone, kind of, and some comedians do that. That can be quite hurtful.
Liam Cosgrave,
I think social media has changed that too, because it's allowed people get personal anonymously as well.
So. I'm going to go to you on Liam Cosgrave. Law and order, is that what stands out?
Yes, in many ways. I mean, we were just saying that the North and partition has been was the big elephant in the room for Irish history, really, since the foundation of the state. And as you were saying, Liam Lynch was sort of caught off guard by it. Or Jack Lynch, sorry. And that was sort of part of his rising to the occasion. And I think with Liam Cosgrave, I think it was Law and Order. It was steadying the ship as well. Actually, he spoke at the launch of his father's biography recently, and he was so articulate and interesting and stressed even now the role of law and order in the police and so on. So I think stability, law and order, and the fact that the 26 counties, the Irish state, could defend itself and hold its own, I think,
and that the Troubles did not spread over
across
the border. Lynch and Cosgrave,
ironically, drawing that border and accentuating that border became more important rather than downplaying it.
He was also, you must remember, very conservative on social issues.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I believe it is alleged. Really never forgave Garrett for encouraging the whole divorce referendum, I gather.
Well, he did vote against his own party's contraceptive bill.
He did. Extraordinary
piece of
Okay, so then we come back to Jack Lynch and we move on to Charlie Haughey. Well, Lord save us, you could talk about Charlie Haughey from
He brought
now.
In the contraception legislation.
Charlie Haughey.
Yeah, I deserved it.
Provided you had a marriage.
You had a prescription, you were married, and you could get it on prescription.
And
he called it an Irish solution to Irish problem. The pill was never illegal, you see, because the pill came in as a cycle regulator.
So
you could get that, but obviously that was about social class, because you could afford it if you went to the right doctor. But he brought in the Irish solution to an Irish problem, which was condoms for married couples on prescription.
I remember explaining that to somebody in their 30s. Who looked at me as if I had lost my complete marbles. And like, how did we as a nation put up with that codology?
Yeah, but we did the other thing, didn't we? You know, I mean, we made our arrangements, you know.
It's gasmarine how every decision a Taoiseach makes kind of speaks to their legacy. And, you know, and as you said, you could have a programme complete or a few programmes on Charlie. But last week, a friend of mine in Kildare told me he went to Galway on the train, free travel down. And, you know, and he referred to it, I was bought down by Charlie's angels, because that's kind of one element of
it
his
is
legacy.
One thing that he did that... Really, it didn't sound like such an extraordinary thing, but by gum, those who have it love it.
They do.
And thank him for it. You know, you hear
people... No, I'm sure you're... text machine could fill up with a list of other legacies.
But we were in government buildings looking out the window at all the pensioners demonstrating against, 2009, yeah, demonstrating against the medical card cuts.
That
special trains put on from Cork and Limerick, more carriages. All travelling for nothing to tell the government what they thought of them.
Nice little irony there. Will Charlie and Garrett always be linked?
Absolutely, yeah.
As the one that side of the...
egos.
Yeah, and what will Garrett's legacy be? The North
Garrett the Good. That's
yeah.
what he was known
as,
Garrett the Good.
Yeah.
The sense of the mistimed, the failures, the constitutional crusade, the beginnings of the peace process as well, the international agenda, going back to what I think what one of your callers was saying.
Yeah, he really did the vision thing, didn't he?
He did. And sometimes it was misguided. Sometimes he missed maybe the views of the people. Sometimes he was slightly too academic. Mm. But the Garrett the Good, I think, will never go, and I think that'll be remembered.
But also the fighting, the animosity between himself and Charlie Haughey. Yes. Was really very palpable at the time.
I remember
time.
Somebody
really
telling me
was.
When the television debates were on that you could, you know, there was electricity flying around the
you
place.
You know, I mean, there's fisticuffs in the Dáil at the moment, but when you think back to what was going on between Charlie Haughey and Gareth Fitzgerald, it was really vicious. And I think there was a personal animosity there that...
And what do you think, Charlie? We just said about Charlie's legacy. We said the free travel. Would you not include anything else in that?
The IFSC, I suppose, and the whole, you know, the whole.
Yeah, we talk about positive legacies as opposed to negative.
Well, there are
negative. Whichever one, negative's pretty long. It's up to you.
I mean, there are negative ones. I mean, of all the Taoiseach, I don't think there were any Taoiseach who, you know, put £1 million in their top pocket from other people. I mean, he was the one, above all of them, who took an enormous amount of money from an enormous number of people.
It's very interesting.
Was it 8 or 9 or 10 million? I mean, you wouldn't see Liam Cosgrave doing something like that. You wouldn't see Bertie O'Hearn do it. You don't see Charles Haughey was the one who did it, and he was a whatever the cliche is at doing it.
It's right. A very simple point.
I just want to move on because I want to get all my Taoiseach in. So that's Charles. Then we've Albert Reynolds, John Bruton, and then we come to Bertie O'Hearn and Brian Cowan, and I guess they're linked as well. Albert Reynolds, people speaking very kindly of him recently.
And your caller was right, Marion, that, you know, his work on Northern Ireland has to be acknowledged.
Yeah.
He did the ground running on it.
Yeah.
He had that basic motivation and vision. And I suppose
an ability to kind of cut through and figure out how
he
to get in.
He also had a common touch. He had a really common...
Absolutely. The most affable man.
Most affable.
He was a lovely man.
John Bruton?
Silence.
No, what do you... I mean, he came in on foot of a breakup and he kept three parties working together.
So being the chairman and keeping the government together.
And the beginnings...
Of democratic left in
the beginnings of economic regeneration and an argument being run by Fine Gael that if we hadn't, in June 97... had John Bruton and the Rainbow come back, would we have had the craziness of the noughties economically? There's a line of country in Fine Gael where they argue that if we had put back the Rainbow under John Bruton, that we could have had a more modulated form of economic development.
Because they did hand over things in very good nick at that stage, it has to be said. Bertie O'Hearn, well, again, we were talking about him. Brian Cowan, you kind of feel at this stage... We hear so little of him now and he's taken such a pasting.
Well, you talk about luck and timing. I think, you know, that's where he actually, that comes to the top of the hill, really. You know, he was only in office kind of a few short months. Now, there is a debate about he was Minister for Finance
That.
And you could kind of go over that. There'll be PhDs written about that, I'm sure. But, you know, he arrived in May and by September, the world had fallen over a cliff. The world complete. But the world was Ireland, you know, as far as everybody was concerned. And the rest of the time, you know, while he might have had a vision, while he had an idea, the whole thing was to shore up the dam at this stage, to try and get a plan in place and to get out. But in order to, you know, to bring Ireland through that, but in order to achieve that, you know, there was an awful lot of very, very, very difficult decisions had to be made. And I think in time, people might kind of reflect on those.
Right. And as you say, making decisions that will damage your own career and putting the country first, even if people don't agree with what
well, that's it. Yeah. That's it. And that's what you're, that's what the gig is. That's what you're paid to do.
Put through the most draconian budget in history and then go and ask people to vote for you.
Yeah. Mm.
Right. OK, listen, we're going to have to leave it there. It was a quick skip. You could do a few hours on many of the people there. And sorry, apologies to the Taoiseach that didn't get as much time as the others. But that's all we've time for. And thank you all very, very much indeed. And to all our contributors today.